Hey everybody, my name is Todd Bieber. I'm the creative director of UCB Comedy, and this is the UCB Digital Podcast. This week we're with SNL's Weekend Update writers. We're going to talk about what it takes to stay relevant and topical when you have places like Twitter, The Daily Show, and all kinds of other competition coming up with funny topical humor almost the instant anything happens. How does Weekend Update stay ahead of the curve? Tonight we have the writers of Weekend Update, and we're going to be talking about the writing process and the production. I don't know what we'll talk about. We'll talk about Weekend Update is what we're going to talk about. But why don't we start by going down the row here, and you guys introduce yourselves and talk about maybe how long you've been at Weekend Update and what your role is there.
I'm Pete Schultz. I'm a writer-producer on Update. It's my fourth season.
Scott Weinstein, I'm the co-producer of Update, and I've been there like 15, 16 years.
I'm Josh Patton. I'm a writer on Weekend Update, and I'm going into my third year.
And I'm Katie Rich, and I'm the girl.
And you've been almost
this
a year.
This is my second season.
Almost a year.
Cool. So we're going to have some good perspectives then, since this is your second year, and this is your 15th or 16th
something
year?
Like that, yeah.
Since you've been there, what was the first?
I interned with when Norm Macdonald was there, and then I really started working when Colin Quinn took over.
Who does that take you through then?
Norm, Colin, Tina Jimmy, Tina Amy, Amy Seth, and now Colin Cecily.
Wow. That's a lot of Weekend Update.
That's a lot of Weekend.
A very brief Horatio filler.
Horatio's
right?
In there a couple of times, yeah. Oh yeah, when Amy was on maternity leave, yeah. He filled in.
So let's just start with I'm curious what, let's start with the micro actually. What does a day look like, or a week look like leading up to Weekend Update, and what your guys' roles in it, and how does it all work?
The first couple of days looks super boring, I would say, to most people. It's just us in front of computers, not really collaborating, just kind of sitting down, writing jokes. Scott has setups ready for us when we come in. He researches through all the news and polls, what are going to be the top stories of that day, and then weird news and all kinds of things. And then we just sit and type away for a while. Every now and then, Katie initiates conversation, and we pause briefly. But yeah, the first couple of days are basically just like that. And we the typical Tuesday writing night that everybody hears about at SNL, we don't typically do unless we're working on a feature. It's mostly just us by ourselves writing jokes in a vacuum until we have a read on Friday for the anchors. So they go through the jokes that Scott and I have called and just highlight what they like. And that's the first time that we have any kind of feedback on what our jokes are like.
Mm-hmm. And from from all of me, Pete, and Katie's perspective, when we walk in the morning or around noon, we have this sheet on our desk that is, it's just a one sentence setup, so it's not gonna be too much into a news story.
It's a ditto you can get.
It is a fill in the blank.
Yeah, it's a fill in the blank, and there's three lines.
And Scott writes the punchlines, and we circle A, B, C.
We circle A, B, C. And then the highest score. And the highest score moves on. So when we walk in on a typical day, that's what we face. And Pete said, we don't have that crazy overnight on Tuesday, because for us it's a little bit more of a slow grind, where we work probably just more longer study hours throughout the week.
The volume is probably higher overall, the number of words and pages and stuff written is because we're writing nonstop all the time.
Right. The amount of time looking at the ceiling going, oh, is probably more than typical writers, just because we're sort of always in that state.
At the end of the day, they each write 30 jokes, give or take, so we have 150 jokes times three, and so plus freelance faxers, so they're usually 400 or 500 jokes that we call through by the end of the week. So it's soul crushing for them, because all of that work is down to we do 12 jokes on air at the end of the week.
Yeah, at most. So,
oh my God, I never thought of that.
Sorry about your soul, Josh.
I don't think it's soul crushing at all.
Nothing crushes your soul.
But I think it's kind of liberating, because it's very, you can't be precious about anything. I actually really love it. It's like you're going to write like all these jokes and the likelihood of them seeing the light of day is very small. I kind of like it.
Yeah, it is nice to know there's a filter for it too, that like it's not the same as like nobody... With a very, to a very limited degree, somebody will filter your stuff that goes to the table as a sketch writer, but you could write stuff that just like totally bombs in front of everybody, and you won't really have that experience on Update. Every now and then, there's a joke that's like,
but not really.
Yeah,
every now and then,
we usually have gotten rid of them by the time anyone else reads them.
There's always one. It's the one that we love the most that gets through that everyone's laughing at all week long. That gets to dress and just. Dead silence.
And people are like, God is real. We don't like that joke.
You have to stop, by the way, writing God's not real as a punchline.
It works, though, for almost every setup.
Tell me about what that setup is, because that's new to me. Like, you come in with a joke, like the first part of the setup already?
We started doing it a long time. I mean, pretty much with Colin, it was... intended as a time-saving mechanism where I would just go through and look through all the papers back then and just type up like a one-line summary and hand it out to the writers. So when the writers came in at 12 or 1, they could just instantly start writing and not have to waste time finding stories. And it's just that's pretty much the purpose of it. So
can you give an example of like what would be something that would attract you to a certain story?
It would start with, I generally go with the top story of the day, whatever sort of on the front page of CNN or NBC or Huffington or whatever, not being a tragedy and not being something awful and not being boring budget stuff and trying to find something that's juicy that they can actually get behind, but still trying to hit all the major things of the day.
So today would be like president announces a new policy to defeat ISIS.
Exactly.
And that's, probably some pull quotes from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then Boehner's response and thing descends down that. Then it would be just anything pop culture-y, something, whatever pop culture stuff happened. Then the best stuff is the weird news, which is much easier to find thanks to the internet. So there's just, you can kind of pull.
They all began, they began a man in Florida.
A man in Florida, yeah, first. It's just a terrible state. There's usually, there's tons of stuff. And then I actually have gotten to the point now where I have to sort of, not fact check, but kind of double check where the source is from because they can kind of be so obscure as to be not believable.
What are your, I get a question a lot of like, what are your sources for those men in Florida type stories?
I try to stay pretty mainstream. So I'll, New York Post is a great place to start there.
No, that like weird news column?
Yeah, weird news column.
There's a HuffPo weird news thing.
Oh, yeah. HuffPo weird news. Yahoo has an oddball site, which is great.
All of Yahoo.
And then I,
It's not that it's not my email and my homepage. Right. Yeah.
Two people, both Pete and Katie, have Yahoo email addresses.
Thank you!
Yeah, so the one hand that went up gives you an idea of like the overall percentage.
I can't see her. Is that person like 55?
How many times have you guys been hacked?
Well, I had to change mine. I have like a Gmail address as well that I have to use at work because I wasn't even getting emails. Like it really would happen where I'd be like, why are you guys getting all these emails? I didn't get anything. And they're like, because you're on Yahoo. It's bogus.
I when I started, I don't know if this is still the case, Seth was on Hotmail, so.
Yeah, I think he still is.
I felt kind of futuristic.
When I emailed you to ask you to be on this, I was like, oh, this can't be Pete's email still.
It's
like, well, some people are bored.
I'm going down with the ship.
Yeah. you guys have UCB experience. I'm not sure. Could you guys talk about, like, I'd like to hear about the UCB experience. Katie, I'm not sure if you have UCB experience or not.
I don't.
Okay, that's fine.
Like, I'm from Chicago.
She's Second City.
Yeah.
She's like legit.
Whoa.
It's not like...
She came from the Second City main stage, right? Is that...
Yes, it's true.
It's a true fact.
Yeah. So maybe talk about how Second City and UCB have influenced how you got here. I'd be interested to know, like, because there's a lot of improvisers here right now, and a lot of sketch comedy, a lot of people coming from similar curriculums. I'd love to hear a little bit about like how that training prepped you for what you're doing now, or if it didn't.
It's a tricky thing because the, like, joke writing is not something that, like, a normal person just does on their own. Like, you wouldn't just sit around and write a monologue for somebody. It's, so you don't know if you can do it. It's just, I think there are things you pick up from just being around funny people all the time, and just working within a comedy community that keeps you sharp and maybe gives you an ability to go to not the most obvious thing. And I feel like jokes, like update style jokes, are a tricky thing because it's the more obscure type of or specific type of reference you might want to make might be over the heads of some people in the audience or like just not something they're familiar with. But if it's something that's too obvious, they're out ahead of you, and it's helpful to have that range, which I think you get from being in this kind of community. And like improvisers, I'm sure, experience this a lot, where I don't have a ton of improv background, but where you find something that's like somehow relatable, but it's like the second thing your mind might jump to, like that kind of like a top of your intelligence type move. And I think that plays into joke writing, not that you're consciously thinking about it, but that you're more in tune with that kind of content.
I agree with that, because there's, you know, the game Take That Back. I don't know if you call it something different.
we probably do.
Yeah, what's
that? New choice. I don't know, so you ring the fucking bell and you say, like, I live in a house. I live with my mom. I live in shit. You know what I mean? Like, but...
Oh, they instantly come up with, like, multiple choices.
Yeah, like, there's the philosophy that in its purest sense is actually then bringing you to a better choice by the third one, because you're like, this is the obvious one, this is the weird one, and then this is where I really should go. And so sometimes I kind of play that by myself. And the other thing someone told me, too, was that writing... Because I'm not a joke writer, but... Someone told me that blackouts are basically like update jokes. So if you're writing a blackout for a sketch, it's the same parts of your brain that light up as when you write a update joke.
Yeah. I think about game a lot when I write jokes.
Game?
Game.
Oh.
You call it Take That Back. I do, because like I think that like when I do improv, I think like the two things that I'm pretty decent at improv, I'm not like good at acting or like real long patient scene work. I am good at like identifying what the game is and like making that tag out move to come in and make the next move, sort of like Pete was talking about a little bit, into like maybe a little less obvious place. And like in terms of joke writing and like looking at setups, for those man in Florida type stories, I've like taught a workshop on joke writing. This is like sort of what I talk about in that at UCB. So I've like to speak the language of game with this. For those man in Florida type stories, for the most part, that's the only thing your audience knows. And like it's like so much of like awareness of what your audience gets and where they are, like that sweet spot between being too obscure and too general and obvious. And for those man in Florida type stories, the audience only knows that. They don't know who this jackass is. They don't know, you know, why the person slapped a police officer with a burrito or whatever. And so you can just play like, oh, okay, there's one like there's a man who's like caught masturbating in a Starbucks, right? So the game of that is Starbucks sex or Starbucks masturbation. So it's like you can like literally just beat out moves on it.
beat out.
So like that's a first move.
That's the first
move. That's your first one.
That's a first move. So yeah, like that idea of like game comes in a lot with those. And then for like the more general stuff, like the, you know, president announcing strategy on ISIS, you sort of have to play within the bounds of what conventional wisdom is and like basically what your audience thinks of all these people. Like
you can't tell them what they think about the president or what they think about ISIS. You kind of have to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
Which is why I think Obama's been such a tricky target in those cases that nobody really knows what they Yeah. It's like, he's a nice man, I want him to do okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Healthcare.gov failing was pretty obvious. Like that tankiness, like, oh, everybody thinks this sucks. So you can sort of dance around that and make jokes. You can make moves on that game. So it doesn't have to be spelled out within the course of a setup because some of the stuff is already there that people think about. Like, like during the 2012 election, it's like Romney's sort of a weird rich robot.
And, but like Putin fights bears.
Yeah. And Putin is a weird supervillain. Yeah. You know? So you can sort of make moves off that game that sort of pre-exists beyond just the bounds of the setup that you're given. Anyway, I just spoiled that workshop. Otherwise, I can teach
the Putin joke writing workshop.
The Putin joke writing workshop. Yeah, it's mostly a drawing class of like different Photoshop.
Josh, we had Sketch 101 together. Do you remember?
We did. Yeah, with Eric Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk about my influence on your?
I don't. You know, throughout history, there have been great minds. Confucius, Jesus, Gandhi, and I think the fourth name in that's Bieber. So.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. You know, we cut down the podcast version of that, so just this segment.
Just that poll quote?
Yeah, yeah. So, right now, like, when Weekend Update started, before all of you guys were there, you know, it was the source of topical comedy, I feel like. And that has changed dramatically, I mean, especially in the last 10 years, and then increasingly so, I feel like, every year. How do you guys stay on top of that? How do you deal with that?
I think by keeping it simple is honestly the best way to go about it. There was definitely, when Daily Show came around, there was a lot of, like, questions of should we start incorporating video, should we start doing a lot of things they were doing. Jon Stewart's Daily Show, I should say. Mm-hmm. And we tried, we kind of played around with it a lot, and we sort of, just for a lot of reasons, discovered it didn't work. And I think at the end of the day, Update is the simplest part of the show, and it's just two people at a desk telling jokes. And that's, I think, what that's when it's its best, that's what it is. And I think in a lot of ways, because we're so simple, that's going to differentiate us from all the other topical shows out there now.
And I think it's, the other thing with it is that it does different things than like Colbert or Daily Show does. Like Colbert, it's character work the whole time. Daily Show is like speaking to a very specific audience that are all kind of on the same page. And you know, there's a lot of video incorporated into that.
And John Oliver now too.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
There's like real long informational walks. Like they all,
right.
Especially like, hey, have you guys watched that show? Mm-hmm. Cool. Like they're like the 10-minute chunk. Is like a lot of explaining an issue.
So they're all obviously really great in their own way. But the advantage that you have on Update is you have just great performers to bring out all the time. So you could do you know, a different take on something by doing a feature. On it, having Kate come out is Angela Merkel and give some like personality to a story rather than like, here's information, here's how you should feel about it, here's how we feel about it. It's just more like, what game can we play based off of the information that everybody has.
I think the Keenan played the cop who arrested Justin Bieber as a feature. And that was fun because that happened on like Monday or Tuesday of that week or whatever. It was super early in that week.
Yeah.
So like every show, like Conan and Letterman and Fallon did jokes on it. And so like to have that sort of different ability to do that after all that happened.
Just find a different way into a story and you have more, just a variety of things you can do that way.
How much do you guys have to watch all that stuff to make sure that you're not repeating a joke?
I watch all pretty much everything.
Yeah.
At least the monologue. When I get home from work.
We all cover it. Like, if I didn't watch it, Pete did, or you know what I mean? Between the four of us, somebody saw everything.
I haven't watched them for pure joy in four years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Weirdly, it's like how I unwind from a day of joke writing. And so Because it's like we are, like I said, it's like a slow grind. So like our brains are like sort of always in joke mode Monday, pretty much all the way through the show. And so, yeah, go home and like watch some jokes to unwind from writing jokes and then like get back to thinking about jokes. So it's like...
We like begin our sentences with joke clauses.
Yeah, I talk in
joke. In his defense.
To be fair, I talk in joking.
How much do you guys have influence? Do you have any the desk pieces, like with Kate or Bobby or?
Some of them. We internally write Terran's Jebediah Atkinson feature. That's like our one that we do. And then some of them, like that Bieber one he was talking about, like it was initiated with an idea that we had. We wrote some ideas down and gave it to Brian Tucker, who's one of our head writers, and he put that together. Because usually it's the, we're looking to get those from the table, from the sketch writers, because we want it to be like a character created by the performer, and then find a way to use that character. And every now and then where we're like, we're strapped for something, and it's coming like Thursday or Friday, and that's like, you know, especially when Seth was still there, a lot of times it would be like in our read on Friday night, he'd be like, huh, this story could be a feature, and then we'd spend the rest of the night coming up with, you know, beats for that.
One of the, going back a little bit to improv training for, this is the first time we've had, I think all the writers have come from improv background and not just stand-up or joke writers. And it's been a big, I think it's a big change as far as on Fridays and Saturdays when we get features, as far as rewriting them. Before it was sort of just the domain of the sketch writers, and in the past 2 years, these guys have been able to really kind of get in there and contribute, and it's been a nice crutch to be able to, for them to enhance these sketches, or these features, I should say.
Yeah, how does that, I feel like it was a, is it stand-ups who were doing it before, or?
If they come from all walks of life. I mean, it's stand-ups, used to be the majority of it, then there would just be guys who wrote jokes. Alex Bays, who wrote for a long time, he did come from an improv background, but
there was a long gap between improv and him
huge,
working.
Huge, yeah. And it was just, he was just a, wrote he's, jokes yeah. and faxed in jokes to us for years and years, and he's just kind of a joke machine, and that was all he did. And there are tons of people out there who just do that, just write jokes all the time.
You say fax in jokes. Do you literally have a fax machine?
No, I am that. I've been there that long.
It's still just called. They would just refer to it as the faxer list. I wish they would. It would be nice to see, just to hear it happening.
Yeah.
So tell me about what faxing in jokes means.
Means basically, I send out the same setups to them, to our freelancers, that I do to these guys, and. At the end of the week, they send in X number of jokes, and we cull through them. And it's a very thankless job. They get like $100 if they get a joke on. We maybe use one freelancer every 2 to 3 shows. So out of those, I don't know how many we have now, but out of the dozens and dozens of jokes they write every week, most of them will probably not see the light of day. And so it's, you know, and then we, if they make it into the pack, then they're into the sort of regular mix with the regular rest of the jokes.
And did you guys start out as faxers?
No. When I was applying for this job, I think that's what I thought I was applying for, because you have to submit to be a faxer. Mm-hmm. I didn't specifically think I was applying for a staff job at Update. It's just a friend of mine who worked there had recommended me, and I just got an email from Alex Bays out of nowhere. So I think we all sort of started cold that way. Mm-hmm. Like we were all recommended by, you know, different people that worked there. And then obviously I was there when Josh was hired. So Baze was able to be like, hey, do you know this guy? You know, we can go through it that way. But everybody, we all, you know.
And you said yes.
I was like, I sort of know him. Okay. Like he's, I mean, I guess he's okay. Yeah. So yeah, it helps to, like, you know, it's usually like somebody will, you know, be recommended, and that's how you end up in there. But if your Baze was just on the faxer list for forever, and that's how he ended up.
Yeah, we didn't cycle through writers very quickly. There were people who stayed for 4 or 5 years at a time, if not more. So it was, there are not many job openings.
Alex Baze was like the head writer for how long?
About four years.
He was in charge of Update my first year. Okay. So, and then I think maybe it was sort of co-in charge of it the year before.
So it was 4 or 5 years.
But I know that he like looked at Twitter a lot for a job. He's the head writer at Seth's show now. I know. I don't know if you heard about this dude named Brian Donaldson, who's like a monologue writer over at Seth's show. He got hired like sort of through Twitter. So I think that is something that people look at now as like a way to hone your skill in an unofficial capacity, especially like on breaking news type stuff when people actually check it for topical news jokes to like not do the same joke that everybody's doing is like sort of neat and is a good way to practice the skill that we have to do like sort of over the course of the week. to do.
Josh, you look pretty great. You still have a great Twitter, right?
No, thanks. Yeah, but Pete does too, and Katie does too, and Scott does too, and you do too.
No, I don't.
Okay. And everybody here has a great Twitter. I don't want anyone to feel like they don't
really
have a
good Twitter.
Twitter
at all. I started it because they were doing it.
She tweeted something like 1,000 retweets
I wanted to be
just
cool.
the other day.
But so don't like. Because, like, that makes me want to throw up. Like, just the thought of, like, you can get discovered on Twitter. Like, always. Like, that makes me want to barf. Like, you can, but, like, that's, it, like, don't worry about it.
It's like, skill building exercise.
And it, like, it bolsters you a little bit. You should be writing every day anyway, and it just forces you to, I guess, write it and put it out there.
Yeah. That's if you're applying for a job like this, they're going to check your Twitter and
Twitter helped me stop being lazy about stuff because I did gravitate towards improv, I think, because I was just like really shitty about writing stuff down in notebooks and like cultivating and doing ideas, and it just made it easier to, and like any medium does this, but if you like you apply yourself to one, it's like, okay, if you have an idea, take the time, think about it, distill it, make it like the best possible version it can be with whatever form it is, whether it's like a 30-minute long thing or just like a sentence long joke, and like a lot of my thoughts and ideas are like one sentence. And so like it just was helpful for me as like just from the notebook perspective of just having like a body of things. Of, like, okay, well, I've worked on this idea as much as I can and this is like the core of it. So I think it's really helpful towards joke writing in a way that some other things might not be.
Yeah, what advice would you guys have for if these guys wanted to catch the attention of not just Weekend Update, but of maybe monologue writing or like, you know, this style of joke, what beyond Twitter might you say like is a good place to start?
I would just be nice to people and be someone people want to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably one.
That's like the main,
and
the main
if
thing.
You're here, that's the biggest thing there is. Like it's everything is, anyone that I know that's gotten a job anywhere, it's been through a connection through UCB or Second City or IO. And it's not like that's the only reason you get it, but that's the reason you're in the position to submit, you know, like the, like only so many people get to submit a packet to SNL, and it helps if you knew somebody on the cast or on the writing staff that could say like this, I can vouch for this person, they're good. Mm-hmm. I had been doing a lot of video work when I was here, as you know.
BP's Spills Coffee director, right?
Sure, yeah.
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 13 million views, still the highest.
No, please. It was a terrible disaster.
Not the video, the BP one.
The BP thing, yeah. No, the video was like
he's also responsible for the oil spill.
Yes. But that's why it had such a good perspective.
Sorry, dumb.
That was proper credit, the writing of that for Shantae and Gavin Spieler and
Eric Tenoy.
Yeah. Tenoy, there he is.
Yeah.
And, you forgot to say Eric's the person who's sitting right
now. I don't know if I noticed that. Yeah. But like I was doing a lot of video stuff, and I did a couple of videos with my friend Christine Nagel, and she had gotten hired there in like 2009. And so when that job opening came up at Update, she had recommended me to Alex Bays, and that's where I got got that email, and that's how I ended up getting in there. I submitted with however many other people you guys looked at, who knows.
How many people, Scott?
Honestly, dozens. What happens is we get recommendations from people we know on staff, and then agents start sending in stuff, mm-hmm. and those are kind of sometimes the worst because they're just comedy writers, but they don't actually know. Like they were trying to become sitcom writers and didn't work out, and they're like, I'll get a job on SNL, and they have never written a joke in their life, and it's very obvious. But yeah, we get dozens. So yeah, he did good. They all did a good job.
Rose. Enough to get hired.
Yeah.
Your favorite joke that you've written?
I know my favorite joke that I've written, and it didn't get on air.
Let's hear it.
And it didn't even get to anything, but it's my favorite.
Let's see.
Can we hear it?
Do I know this?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the waffle taco joke.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what a horrible visual image.
I know. It's that Taco Bell, you know how they start offering breakfast and it makes you want to die? And it was like, they're now offering this and the waffle taco, which is also the term for when you wear fishnets without underwear. This is so funny. And we looked at Urban Dictionary and it wasn't on there. So I'm like, a really cool. But like, Pete and Scott are so nice to me because like, they'll put stuff that they know for, like, we could never use, but they'll put it sometimes in the joke read for Fridays, just so, like, someone says it out loud, and I get to, like, have a nice day. So that's mine!
It's always fun to have those kind of jokes in the joke pack, because, again, we're reading, like, 300-400 jokes in a sitting in, like, a two-hour period, and it can become mind-numbing, and it's nice to have that joke that you... breaks up the room.
We'd always, Josh especially, likes to slip in Billy Joel jokes.
Yeah. Or did in the past. My white whale is to try to get a joke where essentially the fact that Billy Joel's
a drunk driving menace.
So I submit a lot of jokes. And it was a late episode last year, and Cecily told it, and it made it to Dress but not Air. So it's like, I guess, the best of the Billy Joels.
The greatest hit.
And it was, I'm paraphrasing loosely, so forgive me if the details are wrong. But the joke was like, a man in Long Island was arrested after he... like robbed a gas station, then stole a car and crashed it into an audio store. And if it's the Long Island Man, was a Radio Shack. And then like a picture of Billy Joel. See, that worked better in this room than it did in the Dress audience because I prefaced it with Billy Joel's and drunk men. So I don't think everybody knows that.
It's the only thing we remember about Billy.
Right. But who else are we going to use for a drunk driving menace joke?
Yeah, he's the most fun. He's never killed anyone.
He's never killed anyone. It's not like sad, like Lindsay
Destroyed
Lohan.
A couple of like Hampton's
yeah.
hedges.
Right.
But...
It's not like Laura Bush. Did Laura Bush kill a kid?
Yeah, she killed a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. When she was a teenager.
For sure. She ran a stop sign.
When she was a teenager.
Yeah.
There's a lot of celebrities who've killed people.
Oh, yeah.
Matthew Broderick has killed somebody.
Randy? The Neutrogena girl, remember? Rebecca Gayhart.
Rebecca Gayhart.
She ran over a dude.
Yeah.
This is the research we did, and we still came up with Billy Joel.
Because he doesn't kill anyone.
Right, he just crashed his car into a house.
More favorite jokes. I want to hear some more favorite jokes here.
One of my favorite ones... It's not mine. It was one of Alex Baze's. It was two men in like Minnesota had their dead friend's body in their truck, and they were using his credit card at a strip club. And said the two men, "Hey, this is just like that movie we starred in," and then a picture of Andrew McCarthy and Jonathan Silverman, which I loved, but the audience was like, "Who are those people?
What movie was that?" All right. Pete had a joke that we tried three times.
Yes.
Overall, because this was like started the 2012 season when we did a couple Weekend Update Thursdays. So it was like one Thursday, then the next Thursday, and then a Saturday we tried the joke.
With different tweaks to it,
and it never made it to air. And it was, what was the setup?
A woman in Oklahoma was rescued after she was trapped in her freezer for 3 days or something.
Mm-hmm. Right? Rescued by police,
yeah. After she was trapped in her freezer for 3 days. Said the woman, "Is it the year 3000 yet?"
This is their like favorite joke they've ever written.
It's because there's a visual component to it.
And so like the last, because it was just Seth doing update then, and like the last time he had a cue to like peek out of a door. Yeah. He's like, "Is it the year 3000 yet?" Right. Like doing old woman voice.
Yeah.
Still,
the people still weren't on board with the visual.
Well, Josh was always trying to get the CSI Miami joke in, and he finally got it.
He got it
at
the Emmys.
At the Emmys, yeah.
That was his, like, that was another white whale that you...
That was a white whale for a number of years, number of people. I think Baze wrote one a couple years ago.
Yeah, we did it once, right?
We tried it in Dress with with Richard III's body, I think.
Yeah.
Can you give context for...
Sure, it's the CSI Miami intro that David Caruso always makes some stupid pun, puts on a pair of sunglasses, makes a stupid pun about whatever murder he's witnessed, and then the Who song plays. So at the Emmys this year, two of our presenters were Deborah Messing and Jim Parsons. So it's our next presenters, Deborah Messing and Jim Parsons, from their work on some of history's greatest sitcoms. But David Caruso knows them as a couple of Messing Parsons. and then the CSI sting.
And then a look of shock on Seth's face as the joke works.
Yeah.
And then he's just like standing there as a piece of scenery like kind of creaks.
Because he was like fully expected to like go with a bail on the joke.
Yeah, he had a bail all lined up. Yeah.
And then Seth, like, as he was coming off stage, he had the sunglasses, right? And the prop lady wanted them. And he was like, hell no, these are Josh's.
Got those.
So he wears them at work sometimes just to like show us he's successful.
Scott, what are some ways that this show has changed since you've been there?
It's changed a lot and hasn't changed a lot. How it's at the end of the week, it's still people reading off cue cards, so in that sense it hasn't changed. There are a lot of answers. The digital shorts are a bigger part of the show than they've been since we started. I think the sensibility of the show has changed a little bit since in my time, at least, as far as update. I mean, when I started, we were happily making jokes about O.J. Simpson killing people, and I really don't think we would do that today. I think, not to get too serious, but on the anniversary of 9/11, I think that did change kind of the idea of, like, these stories we're making fun of. Actually, some people have lived through these tragedies, and so I think we moved away from the tragedies. I got too serious.
This just reminded me of this. I was shooting some web videos that I do, that sound advice web series of Vanessa's, and I realized that I kept saying "let's roll," and I feel like that's like a really weird thing to say repeatedly on September 11th. It was like very like that was something that was in my head that I kept thinking like, oh, this is like. It's like, it feels like a joke, but you don't want to say it because it's, and that's, I think it's that, it has been that, probably since then, is probably, right. Like, we wouldn't be making Ray Rice jokes right now.
No. Yeah. It would be about the NFL.
But it wouldn't be,
That's the thing, like, you don't make fun of the tragedy, you make fun of people.
It has to be something, to be something, like, tangential.
For sure.
I think it's that we're more accountable now in the, through social media, basically, like, again, when I started, we were operating in a vacuum. Like, the only feedback I think we really got was A, the audience, and then B, somebody like the New York Times would review us once every 2 years and say we're dead, and that's, you know, move on from there. But all of a sudden now, instantly, you're going to hear what worked, what didn't work, what people are upset about, who you offended.
Like, for instance, if like right after update, you started like typing like your joke into Twitter to see like if somebody was like saying something about it, like you could do that and find out if like people liked it or didn't like it. Not that we would do that, but you could.
That's how I started on Twitter though, because like that's one of the reasons I used to smoke, and I started smoking only because like in college everyone smoked and I got sick of like standing outside and not doing anything, so I was like, fuck it, I'll just smoke. And so when we would be done with update, nerd herds would be like on their phone like looking at Twitter to see the responses, and I was like, oh, I guess I have to do that too. So now that's why I got into Twitter.
Yeah, well, it was
secondhand Twitter.
It was fun when it first saw the trending stuff to like, oh look, Stefan's trending. Yeah. My god, the world's talking about it for 10 minutes. But then speaking of feedback, like, I remember Seth did a joke a couple of years ago about some of the bike riders in the city, and something about the punchline of like a bike rider riding into the back of a taxi cab. And it did fine, and then instantly he got some message from somebody like, that's not funny, so many people are killed, and bike riders are killed in the city that way, and he was like, oh, maybe I should have done that joke, and you do, but not...
It used to be, they used to, like, have to call reception, complain to the receptionists, and then, like, then it would get back to people.
It was only insane people who called in. Like, only insane people.
Yeah. And I think that, like, the fact that we're, like, a more broad audience network show matters, too. Like, we, like, there's finer lines for us to walk than there are for, like, you know, tuning in. I can't even think of, like, a good example of a show, but, like, this, okay, forgive me for this terrible analogy, but when you watch Real Sex on HBO, like you expect
and,
to see
when you take a time machine back to 1998,
you know, when you're watching couples who are in their 50s now be interviewed to Calypso music,
sex hammock.
Like when you watch Real Sex, you like you understand like, okay, I'm gonna tune in and probably gonna see some gross, ugly, naked bodies, and I'm okay with that because that's what I'm tuning in for. I think people tune in to SNL with like a general sense, like, oh, I'll laugh. And but there's like there's so many different sensibilities that there's like, and sort of like, yeah, to get away from like what Scott was saying about like jokes where like the punchline is that like, whoa, that's real shocking, is like good for us. Like that's not, that's a way to you know, I think it helps our joke writing skills too.
Yeah.
To stay away from that.
So talk maybe about a little bit about the political point of view of the show. Is there a political point of view of the show, and do you have to find a balance between that?
You've been here longer.
I would say there is and there isn't. We're, the writers all do have, I mean, we lean left. It's, that's just nature, I think, in New York. But it doesn't, I don't think it influences the comedy that much. It's, we get accused of that, but the fact is we're looking for what's funny about what's funny, and you know, there's nothing terribly funny about Obama right now except for his policies, and that's not funny. What's funny is a president sleeping with his intern, and what's funny is a president who's too stupid to be president. Like that, those are things that people can understand quickly, and
it's like they, it's, I feel like the audience tells us more what the political point of view is. Mm-hmm. It's a very mainstream show. Mm-hmm. And it's, you're not gonna like force politics on somebody, so it's not, especially not in like a 20-second joke. It's not, you know, people aren't gonna make up their mind and laugh at it. You might be able to do a slightly more like politically slanted like rant on something. Mm-hmm. But even those are, they're mostly just joke based, and what do people wanna hear about, and what are they gonna laugh at? And with like Obama, for instance, we've tried a million different things, and something specific has to happen with him. Like what he did very badly in that first debate with Romney, that gave you, for a week, you had handles on him where you could be like, okay, he sucked at this, and we can just call him out for sucking on this. But it's, people generally don't like when you take hits at him, because they haven't decided, like, I think this guy is, like, there's not a lot of good jokes about somebody being aloof, and people haven't, they don't know that that's what they think about him. They just feel like, I think that the people that hate him so much, there's nothing you could say on television that would make them laugh. Like, you'd have to say something so awful. And the people that love him so much, they're like, how could you do, you know? And then in the middle, everyone's just like, whatever, just next guy.
Personally, I think it's funny that there's like 2.5 more years of his presidency. He obviously doesn't want to be president anymore.
Yeah.
He's like, all he wants to do is like go back to Illinois and smoke cigarettes.
It's like, that's all I want to do.
But it's tough to convey that. Like, it's really, yeah. It's like, yeah, like we don't get a lot of clapter, like that clap of like laughter that's like overwhelmed by like, yeah, good point, you know, right. Which is good.
You mentioned something and people were like, I recognize that. Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like, and like that is like our gauge, is to just like, we gauge off laughs. So whatever works. We don't like between dress and air, we don't cut jokes because like, oh, well, this one got more laughs, but wow, what makes a better point? It's like, no, that one got more laughs. That's the one that's in. Regardless of what it is.
Although, to be fair, if there is a joke that we will believe in, and like particularly the anchor, because ultimately they're the ones who have to stand by the jokes. If they believe in it and they want to keep the joke in, we'll do it if it makes a point that they like. But typically we'll get, if the joke does get kind of clappery response, we kind of get rid of them. That's we don't want a chorus of people like screaming that they're happy to be there.
Yeah. And how much do you guys, speaking of the anchor, like, has that changed, like, because there's been a turnover this year? Does that change the style of jokes that you write? Influence?
I think every anchor has their own voice that you kind of have to find, and a certain skill set that they can deliver. Like, it was Seth for a lot of years, where it was Seth, and you knew what Seth did well, and you would find like little new moves here and there, but it was pretty well defined.
What do you think that was?
I think with Seth, it could be generally just like a clean joke, not like clean content wise, but just like that's very crisp and clear what it is. He can sell a lot of things on the kind of the attitude he has in a really, of kind of like the, you know, it's a little snarky, but it's not over the top snarky. And he loves to do like German accents.
German accents.
If you give him somewhere, he can do a German accent.
Yeah.
There's like you, and you know what his, if he also, his, I think his taste in jokes refined even over the time that I was there, because he's done so many of them, like he would get bored of a certain type.
Picture jokes. He loved picture jokes.
Yeah.
Anytime we mocked up like two dogs wearing a lab coat, that that's his sweet spot.
But that like is normal to love.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. In our offices, we have a bunch of framed photos of the little the over the shoulder graphics like from years past, and like right next to me is a group of squirrels in a lab coat. This is what I look at it probably 100 times a day.
There's the menacing Bert. With the knife.
Yeah. It was Give Me a Reason, Bert.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not Tickle Me Elmo, but Give Me a Reason, Bert. And Dora the Terrorist?
Something, yeah. She's like, it's Dora the Explorer with a dynamite bomb.
Oh, I think it was like the Hamas version of Dora the Explorer as well. Oh, yeah.
Right.
And Lutz holding an actual Blackberry. Right. Lutz is an Amish guy. Yeah.
Holding a Blackberry.
Yeah.
Let me start opening up to some questions. Yeah. Questions?
We answered everything.
Comprehensive.
How many jokes on one topic do you write?
That really depends on the week. Like if it was like the presidential debate was that week, like you knew you needed to have three or four good ones to take to address on that. So you would spend a good chunk of time writing debate jokes. And once you have your top stories covered, it's just kind of like catch all, and it's whatever you feel like, whatever setup you feel like you have the most stuff on, you kind of go from there. But there's not like, there's no like hard and fast rule to it.
It's usually after part of the process. I don't think we sort of explained this after. On Friday nights, after we go through the picks that the anchors make, we whittle them down to about 30 jokes that we're going to focus on Saturday. And at that point, we go through and kind of see if we've hit what's major stories, because we really have to get the first, probably like the first four jokes need to be really topical, and then nobody cares at that point. But if we don't have anything for that, that's typically when these guys will go back and sort of write, we need, you know, we don't have anything on ISIS this week, so we got to go back and they'll spend Friday night finding out
the right beheading take.
Yeah, exactly. It's really a good funny beheading joke.
Yeah. I think like with the presidential debates, I think from memory's sake, it's probably like page and a half, 2 pages of jokes a day. Like if a presidential debate happened like a Tuesday or Wednesday, probably like page and a half, 2 pages of jokes. Midterm elections coming up, that'll probably be the case. Like that happens on Tuesday, so probably like, you know, a couple pages.
With the speech on ISIS, we probably would have had a separate page of setups on that.
So that's like for those big stories, it's like that. For your average story, it's like with what I was talking about, like this stuff where it's like, oh, it's like a Man in Florida type story. Like, yeah, like the game, like the idea of game where you just write out some beats, like get three or four good beats, why not write them all? And it's like totally fine to do that.
Yeah.
Like,
Sometimes they turn into, like, you stack them together. We do a couple on the same setup.
Yeah, we do that with Bruce Jenner and, what's her name?
Chris Jenner.
Yeah, when they got divorced, we did like 5 or 6
They didn't get divorced.
They filed.
They separated.
What? Oh, God.
I'm trying to work it out.
God, you people are still holding on.
What do you want to talk about? What else is there to talk about?
Chris.
It's probably kind of like asking Doctor Who fans which one's their doctor, but like
David
which...
Tennant.
There you go. Matt Smith.
Okay, that's fine.
Which, like, Weekend Update host were you the biggest, like, fan of, either, like as a professional or younger?
I'll say my... I had a couple growing up where I think the person that clicked with me the most was Norm, because that was... You know, when he came on, I was in my early teens, and that was, the right attitude to have at that time. Like, there was something very punk rock about the way that he presented himself, and that's the kind of thing that I cared about. And so I think if I had to look back at somebody in my youth that hosted it, it would probably be him. But there was, you know, I was also very into Dennis Miller when he hosted it, and Kevin Nealon as well, so... it was always kind of my favorite part of the show.
I grew up with Dennis Miller. That was my guy. Yeah. And I will not say a specific anchor I've worked with, because they'll listen to this.
Yeah.
The one when I was 13 years old, which would have been Norm, right?
Yeah.
That's like a lot of, I think like a lot of,
yeah.
It's like NFL running backs, or like best basketball players. It's like, well, whoever it was when you were 13. You?
I like Amy. I liked Amy and Tina the best. I mean, just, I don't know. I don't have to explain that. I think Amy, for me, I just liked her because she never seemed to take herself too seriously, and but yet still came across as being very well informed. So I like that balance of, like, I am just telling jokes, but I have the right to be here.
Veronica, did you?
Yeah, I just want to know what your first week on the job was like. Was it like a nightmare?
Well, I'm very interested to hear Scott's.
My first week, I started as an intern. My first week was right, it was after Adam Sandler and all those guys left. And it was Will Ferrell and Molly and Sherry. And their first season. At that point, like, nobody watched the show because it was just a complete reset. And I remember my first day walking in, I'm like, I know that's Will Ferrell, and I do not know if any of these other people on the show or not. And so that was a little scary, but.
How old were you?
I was 20, probably 22, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah. By the way, like, Scott does everything. If Scott, like, didn't come to work one day, nothing.
There wouldn't be a show.
Nothing would happen.
Yeah.
Like, he really does do everything.
Right. Like, we'd be throwing and ripping up newspapers.
Yeah.
Like, what are the stories?
We would just be feral cats Scott wasn't there.
What was your first week like? Because you had the most recent one.
Mm-hmm.
I know you were. It was really fun. I remember, like, I have an anxiety disorder, so I remember, like, being worried about that the most, that, like, that was going to kick in. And then I remember it not kicking in at all, except, like, when we were at the first meeting and Seth was like, oh, we have a new writer. And then I was like, who? And I was like, I have to get out of here. It just became very clear, like, I work with them, like, they're the nicest people you could possibly work with, and they're so supportive, and I was like their retarded little sister, and, like, I still kind of am, where it would just be like, wait, what? Wait for me, guys! And there's still kind of a lot of that, too, so. But I don't know, it was, I remember, like, writing jokes and being like, just, like I said, like, feeling little parts of your brain light up that hadn't before, and being like, oh, maybe I could do this. And it was very, very humbling, because you quickly realize, like, oh, I can't. Like, this is really, really hard. Because, you know, you watch Weekend Update, you're like, I'll write that joke, I'll do that. and it's like, no, you can't. It's really hard. And I was just, I think I was just so impressed. I was so impressed with, like, what a well-oiled machine it is. And it quickly becomes a job. Like, that's the other thing, too. Like, people are like, well, we work at SNL. And, like, it quickly becomes like, yeah, but I have a job to do that I could lose. And so I get that Robert De Niro's there, but I can't really think about that right now.
Asking for the Wi-Fi password.
I know, shuffling out, like, this Wi-Fi! He did.
It's a great, so like, that's my Robert De Niro story,
really
is that he came up and asked me for the Wi-Fi password, and I don't want any other interaction.
No,
that's
you
perfect.
Shouldn't.
unless it's years later to thank you.
Yeah. he knew I was wrong about the Wi-Fi password.
I know, he didn't even give him the right one.
He was like,
that
no.
don't work.
No.
Isn't that great?
That was really good.
My first week was so surreal, like my first day especially, because there was nobody in the office. They were all out at the Emmys, like the Emmys were on Sunday, and nobody was back in time for Monday. So I came in, Scott was there, gave me like setups, and like left halfway through the day. And so I was just like sitting by myself in this place that I'd like dreamed about working for my whole life, being like, is this right? Is this, like, you just type things? And, like, where do I put it after this?
Yeah.
And there was nobody in the office, like, to even, like, ask a question to. And I was like, this is, all right, I'll just type a bunch of things, and then at some point I'll leave. And then the very next day they came, you know, everyone came back, and then there was a topical meeting. And then in that topical meeting I was looking around and being like, huh, okay, that person's on TV. Oh, that person's also on TV. And, like, should I even be here? I don't feel like I should be here. Like, this is like the wrong spot. But luckily I knew, like, I had some friends there. I knew Bobby. Bobby was my Improv 101 teacher. So that was like a little bit comforting at that moment. And Bobby used to come up to me like the first, like maybe the first 6 months that I worked there, and every time he'd see me, he'd grab me and be like, do you believe you work here? Yeah. Just like, because he's, and that's his attitude all the time. So.
My first week was different because, like, a few weeks before the season starts, we like write some. We'll come in early to write some commercials and stuff like that needs more production time. And so I came in and did that. So like my first, it was super weird. It was cool, but it was also like, okay, cool. Yeah, I can't wait. I got hired as a joke writer for Weekend Update. Awesome, awesome. Okay, I'll write some commercial parodies, which to that point I had written the one that we wrote in Sketch 101, which you remember.
I don't.
But that was like the only commercial parody I'd ever written. And so I like came in and was like, okay, I'll do this.
Did you turn that in? Did you turn that one in?
Oh, no, I burned it long ago. Yeah.
My first one I turned in was one that was in my packet.
Nice, good shortcut.
Very smart.
I mean, it wasn't good.
Yeah, so that's it. But the first actual week of joke writing, I remember, like, the first day, I think, like, what you were saying of, like, sort of the humblingness of it, the first day, I was like, all right, I got some sweet jokes, let's turn them in. And then, like, the next day, I, like, looked at the jokes that Pete and Alex Bays, who were the other writers there at the time, was like, oh, okay, yeah, I should get a lot better at this. I should be way less cocky. The volume's really tough at start for, I would imagine, like, sketch writers, too, and, like, for us, the volume really gets to you, but not, like, that curve to get there.
I think
like
there's sort of a similar learning curve for the sketch writers and the joke writers. Joke writers, because nobody, like I said before, nobody writes jokes. That's just not a thing that normal human beings do outside of like Twitter, where you sort of do it.
Yeah.
And sketch writers, like writing a sketch for SNL is completely different than writing it for UCB or any, like there's moves. There are people people could put up something that killed on the stage here and it goes to the table there and is like, plays real soft, and that's really disheartening to people to start out. And then there's that curve of like learning, like, okay, how do I write something for the table and also for the audience? And they kind of like slowly figure it out. Or if you're like Chris Kelly or somebody, like you very quickly figure it out.
Yeah.
You also just have to write stuff that's really bad. Like, I don't know, you just write a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah.
And it's okay, like, you're just like, I did it! I still did, you know, because, like, I remember being, like, very paralyzed, like, I'm not going to write anything until it's perfect, and it's like, well, you're going to write mostly garbage, and then eventually it'll be less garbage.
Yeah, it's just, like, pushing through that's probably, like, the biggest
thing. That's the hardest part. And it doesn't get easier, you just get better at it. Like, it's still hard, but you're not throwing as much spaghetti at the wall. You kind of know where to throw it.
Makes sense.
The setups for like the A Man in Florida seem pretty clear because that like A Man in Florida did something stupid. But for stuff that is topical like Obama's speech, mm-hmm. like you must have more than just one setup for it. Or do you just have one setup or is it
depends
just like
depends on what the story is. My general kind of rule of thumb is I feel like the setups for those type of political stories should be a reminder to the audience what happened. Because if you have to explain from the get-go what happened, by the time you explain it all, they fall asleep. So it really needs to be a reminder. It doesn't have to provide too much information. Then if there's more moves to the story, it'll be a separate. It'll usually be like the second or third joke of update will be like. And then also Bain responded to the ISIS comment saying.
And so for like the actual speech, like we didn't come up with setups for this week, but there would be probably one that says like this Wednesday President Obama gave a speech outlining a new aggressive policy towards ISIS, and then another one that's probably like this week in President Obama's speech on ISIS he called for airstrikes in Syria, like just those different like the main like sort of bullet points I guess right is like what those setups
there'll be like one or two details I'll pull out of it but and you get too obscure and. People either won't believe you or they just don't know what you're talking about.
You also don't have to write a joke for every setup. That's another thing that like takes a long time to learn, I think, is like, so even though Scott's giving us all these setups, like there's some that you look at and you're like, I got nothing. And Pete was like, it's just like SATs, like you just skip it. And that's nice too, to know that like if you really look at something and you're like, no, it's okay.
Yeah, because they can't predict.
We don't write one for everything.
Yeah, and you can't predict going when you're writing jokes on Monday what is going to be work on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So you just have to kind of write it, and the editing process at the end of the week will sort of figure out what we need. Because again, and the news changes by the end of the week too. That's another big thing.
And a lot of jokes are chewed up by other monologues, so you have to find a different way into it.
And like I think, like last year. A recurring story was like either the fiscal cliff or what was the other one, like the debt,
NSA.
All those different like stopgap deals that Congress went through was like sort of the front page story in a lot of weeks.
Yeah,
and so for that, like a lot of the setups that were more fertile were like ones of like what John Boehner said about this or what Obama said about this. So it's like an issue that everybody knows about, but it's like this week in response to the budget crisis. All right, in reference to the fiscal cliff, Ted Cruz did this. So that's like a way in on some drier areas. That IRS thing, too. There's a story. And then AP's, NSA scandals are like, things don't really, it's not a sex scandal. So
there was like a year straight of just boring budget stories.
We were so glad when Dave Petraeus fucked his biography.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the best thing in the world.
That's actually one of my favorite update jokes, and it's one that Pete came up with. The morning of the show. Do you remember what it was?
It was reported that Dave Petraeus had an affair with the woman who wrote his biography, All In. Of course, when they started working on the book, it was called Just the Tip.
You like tip jokes.
Yeah. Listen, it's a funny word.
I know, it's so funny.
It's got the two-part consonant sounds at the end.
It lands nicely on tips.
I think we have time for one more question. Mac, did you have one?
During the like off season when you guys are like summer break or whatever, do you guys like do anything to keep yourselves sharp for writing, or is that do you need that time to decompress and just empty your brain for a while?
Kind of both. It depends. Like sometimes, like Josh and I have both taken like different summer work. Like worked on like this year we wrote on the Emmys, and last summer we did like the ESPYs and the Franco roast and things like that. So just like little jobs where you do bursts of joke writing, and then sometimes it's just like, you know, not something for television, like somebody Seth is hosting something, or you know, Colin or Cecily's got to do something. Mm-hmm. Like you write jokes for them at their hosting thing. So there's opportunities to keep yourself a little bit sharp, but you also need that time to be like, at least a couple of weeks where you're like, I don't want to think about a joke, I don't want to hear the news, like I don't want to, you know. I don't want to do anything comedy related. I like go home and watch like like murder shows. Like I watch like I won't watch anything unless it has at least one detective.
Yeah. No joke. Pete's two favorite shows are Investigation Discovery and River Monsters.
But I love River Monsters. No, not a hint of comedy in River Monsters. Just a man dead serious about his quarry.
I worked at an ad agency to like make me feel better about everything. Because I was like, oh, this isn't my job, for real. So it was fun. So I was still writing and still like making money.
Can we say what you came up with that everybody knows?
They'd love to do this.
Yeah.
Which is lame.
Katie was the person that came up with the KFC ad campaign. I ate the bones.
Yeah.
an idea that she came up with.
But here's the thing, like, how would you know if I didn't? Like, you can't.
Wait a second.
No! No, I really did. That's real.
It would be a brilliant specific.
I know. That's the thing why it's so funny. It's like.
Do you think that kept you sharper? You did that this summer, right? Mm-hmm. Did that keep you sharp, you think?
Yeah, because then we ended up writing a campaign that was all stand-up jokes. So it actually, I did end up just writing jokes anyway. Yeah. But I was glad to do that because it's like, that's even more gross and bureaucratic than network television, so.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Round of applause for these guys.
UCB Digital Podcast is brought to you by UCB Comedy. Visit the YouTube site, youtube.com/UCB Comedy, for new videos every weekday from New York to Los Angeles. The best videos you'll ever see. Follow us on Twitter at UCB Comedy, on Facebook at UCB Comedy, on Tumblr at UCB Comedy, on Instagram at UCB Comedy.